I always hate hearing that term. That's not fair. Pioneer makes it sound like you're really as old as you are. I would like to say it's always a great honor and a privilege to be invited to these kinds of workshops, and I appreciate the invitation from Bridget, Clint, and Ron to speak to you today. I've been at a number of these workshops over the years. Back in the old days that Nigel and David can remember, there was a group of maybe 10 or 15, and so this is a fantastic illustration of the rapid growth of this technology and the interest in this technology. One thing I want to make very clear up front is this kind of talk, it's going to be impossible for you to take notes, so I just want you to sit back. Don't go to sleep, but sit back, relax. I'll do all the work for you. And the idea today is I'm going to focus strictly on methodology and just to try and tell you how do we go from images of viruses, spherical viruses, to 3D reconstructions. I'm not going to spend really any time at all telling you about the interesting biology we can learn by doing these kinds of studies. So quickly, the outline for today's talk, we'll start with a little bit of background information, and I have to tell you a little bit about symmetry, a little tutorial about symmetry, and then the main guts of the talk will be about so-called typical procedure, go through a schematic diagram and description of how we go from electron micrograph to a 3D reconstruction. And then if I leave myself any time, which is doubtful, I'll finish up by saying something about some of our current and future strategies. So the field really got started back in 1970 when Tony Crowther, Linda Amos, John Finch, and this guy here, I don't know, he's sitting in the back there. Are you really that old, David? And Aaron Klug. Yeah, right. Yeah. And this was before my time, too. Anyway, they did the first reconstruction of negatively stained icosahedral viruses. And this particular paper talked about human wart virus, tomato bushy stunt virus. And there are two classical papers that I really think everybody should read at some point in their lives if they're interested in this kind of technology, published in 1970 and 1971, which give the real basic details of the methodology that pretty much is still used today. So these so-called Fourier Bessel mathematics and these common line procedures. And then more recently, I wrote a research review article with Norm Olson and Steve Fuller. And for those of you who are real diehards, I brought copies of this review article, which will go into a little bit more detail of what I'm talking about today. And so for those people that really are very much interested in this sort of technology, you're welcome to a copy of that review article, and please take them because I don't want to have to carry them back to Indiana. Also, for those of you who are interested, I've prepared a reference list to try and give you an idea of where the technology has gone since 1970 and some representative examples of high-resolution structures that have been solved and some other related references for those of you that are interested in this technology. Okay, so over the years, our group has studied a wide variety of spherical viruses, and so have other people out here in the audience. Wachu's group has done a large number of spherical viruses, Mark Yeager, and there's maybe 10 or 15 groups in the world now that are learning some interesting biology about how viruses infect cells. But again, that's not the purpose of my talk today. I just want to tell you how do we get these pictures of these different viruses using the technology that we have. So let me just say a few words about symmetry. And there's two topics I'm going to talk about very briefly. The first thing is what is this so-called 532 point group symmetry, icosahedral point group symmetry. To go back all the way back to Plato, you recall from your probably high school mathematics or maybe even before that, that there are only five platonic solids, five and only five, no more, no less. And if you start with equilateral triangles, you can make the simplest platonic solid you can make is a tetrahedron, which is where you take equilateral triangles and you bring three of them together at each three faces at each vertex, that produces a tetrahedron. If you take four faces at each vertex, you produce an octahedron. If you take five faces, again, all equilateral triangles at each vertex, you produce an icosahedron. That's all you can do with triangles. If you take squares, you have only one choice. You can take three faces at each vertex to produce a cube. And the last one is a dodecahedron, from which you start with pentagons, place three faces at each vertex, and you produce this thing called the dodecahedron. That's basically the five platonic solids. Well, the icosahedral structure, which has the so-called 532 point group symmetry, it has 12 vertices. Okay, you can see, I guess you can see all of them if you look at the dotted lines here, which are behind the solid object here in schematic. And at each vertex, if you were to draw a straight line from the vertex through the center of the particle, it would pass through this back vertex here, and that would be an axis of five-fold symmetry. And so there would be six axes of five-fold symmetry that join the 12 vertices. And that's illustrated here. Okay? An icosahedron, that is this platonic solid, the icosahedron, also contains 20 faces, 20 triangular faces, as I said before. And if you draw a straight line from the center of a face through the center of the object back through the backside, which is also an equilateral triangle, you have 10 threefold axes of symmetry, and those would be here. The one you're looking down right here appears as a dot, but the other ones appear as drawn. The last thing that identifies the icosahedral platonic solid is it has 30 edges, 30 of these lines. And again, if you draw a line from the center of the line through the center of the particle out the back end, you have 15 twofold axes of symmetry. Hence, 532. That object possesses all of those axes of symmetry in the combination given by the geometry of this platonic solid. And there are the twofold axes of symmetry. Now, if you bring back the dodecahedron, it's an interesting case because both of these solid objects have different shapes, as you can see quite clearly, but they both have 532 symmetry. So in the case of the icosahedron, again, 12 vertices, 20 faces, 30 edges. It gives rise to 6 5-fold axes, 10 3-folds, and 15 2-folds. Whereas the dodecahedron has 20 vertices instead of 12, 12 faces, and 30 edges. But it has 10 3-folds, 6 5-folds, and 15 2-folds. Well, these objects, because they're highly symmetric, they actually consist of a number of asymmetric units. And in the case of an icosahedron or a dodecahedron, they both consist of what's called an asymmetric unit, which is 1/60th of the whole object. So in the case of an icosahedron, that would be here. If you draw this triangle here, this is not an equilateral triangle. This is an equilateral triangle. But you go from a threefold axis to the nearest fivefold axis and enclose that triangle there. You can generate 60 of those to make the entire icosahedral structure. So in fact, this is considered the asymmetric unit of the icosahedron. Likewise, in the dodecahedron, you have a structure that looks similar to, but not quite the same, but this is the asymmetric unit of a dodecahedron. The important point here is that this object or this object consists of 60 identical, quote-unquote, subunits that are arranged with icosahedral symmetry. Because the operation of any of these axes of symmetry will generate all the other 59 from that first one. So these are highly symmetric objects. Now here's a drawing that Don Casper did a number of years ago. This happens to be an icosahedron made of 60 left hands. Okay, so an icosahedron must have 60 identical objects arranged with 532 symmetry. And one thing about icosahedral structures, this is a structure, is that you can look at it in different ways. So for example, I can look at and color these two hands here green and consider them a unit, okay, a dimer of left hands. Then there will be a total of 30 of those dimers of left hands will make up the entire structure. Or you can look at the same structure in a different way. Look at the three now colored yellow left hands as a trimer, and there will be 20 of those. Okay, and the symmetry that relates them is given by a threefold axis, which would come out here. Of course, there's going to be 20 of those that I would color yellow to make up the total of 60 left hands. And lastly, you could consider grouping them as a pentamer, and there would be 12 of those, one at each of the vertices. Nothing has changed about the symmetry, just the way you look at that structure. Okay, so there's different ways you can look at exactly the same structure. Now, this business of triangulation symmetry, well, this could be a topic of a seminar by itself, and so I'm not going to go into the gory details of it, but just make it clear that, in fact, it's a purely mathematical concept because it considers mathematical points and the distribution of those points in three dimensions. But it's useful for us to think about because if you read the literature and you see this mention of triangulation symmetry, you wonder what it is. Basically, with real objects, for example, viruses that have 5-3-2 symmetry, more often than not, you'll see that these viruses consist of not just 60 subunits, but multiples of 60 subunits. The consequence of that is that these subunits are arranged such that you generate additional local or pseudo-symmetries. And if you want to understand the structure, you have to understand something about those symmetries and why they're there. So, again, going back to this gallery of virus structures that we've looked at over the years, let's just take, for example, herpes simplex virus. The so-called T number that's associated with this is T equals 16, and I'm not going to derive for you, you know, how we get these numbers, but the students in the faculty, if they want to ask me about that, we can go through that, but it takes a while to go through the explanation. The best way to look at it is that, in fact, you can see with your eyes that this herpes virus, the outer capsid here, consists of pentamer-shaped units and hexagonal or hexamer-shaped units. Okay? And so these hexamer-shaped units, in fact, sort of violate the laws of the strict icosahedron, but they don't sit on icosahedral symmetry axis. So you have groups of 5 and groups of 6. And the T number, in most cases, can help predict for you how many sub-subunits there are within each asymmetric unit. So in the case of rotavirus and reovirus, although it's a little bit harder to see this, they both consist of what are called T equals 13 LAVO lattices, LAVO meaning left-handed. There are both possibly left-handed or right-handed structures in nature. Here's three examples of T equals 4 structures. This is an alpha virus, an envelope virus. Here are two insect viruses. They both have T equals 4 triangulation symmetry, but they're completely different structures, as you can see. There's examples of T equals 7, human papillomavirus, polyomavirus. These are T equals 7 dextro. The plant virus, CCMV. The insect virus, flockhouse, are T equals 3 structures. There's a variety of T equals 1 structures. The bacteriophage is SPV4, YX174, the coronaviruses, human rhinovirus, polio, the parvovirus. These are T equals 1 structures. And LA1 is kind of an oddball because it sort of violates all the laws, and it's sort of a quasi-T equals 2. So I'm not going to tell you why this is. And in fact, here's one of the larger ones we've looked at, an algovirus, which has a T lattice symmetry of 169D. Those numbers can tell you something about how all the subunits must be arranged in this beautifully icosahedral structure. But the main take-home point that I want to leave you with, the key concept here is, in fact, that this T symmetry is not incorporated into or enforced by any of the algorithms I'm going to talk about. So what that means is that if you get a reconstruction and you've done it correctly, and correctly is the important word here, is that this will emerge as a result from your analysis. You don't put that in, so you know, you don't enforce the structure to obey a certain T symmetry. It will just come out from the reconstruction process. Now, there are two basic assumptions, which are true for many different image processing techniques. And that is that, number one, you make the assumption when you prepare your specimen, put it in the microscope, take pictures, that you have a homogeneous sample of particles that are stable and have identical structures. Otherwise, various kinds of image averaging techniques aren't going to work. If the structures are different, you shouldn't be averaging them. So one assumption is that the data that you're looking at must have a stable structure that is constant. And the second assumption is that your programs can be used to both test for and assume the presence of a particular symmetry. In our case, we assume icosahedral symmetry. We don't assume any T-lattice symmetry, but we assume icosahedral symmetry, we can actually use the program to test to see that, in fact, do our particles obey that symmetry. But for the most part, we can learn early on whether a particle does have that symmetry or not. And once we decide that it does, then we enforce that in the process. So the symmetry that comes out has been enforced by the process. And that's also true of other techniques as well, whether you're enforcing some kind of a helical symmetry or some kind of a two-dimensional translational symmetry in the case of crystals, 2D crystals. You have to work on these assumptions, though. Okay, so now let's talk a little bit about the typical procedure, the nuts and bolts. But before I launch into a description of sort of the procedure itself, I think it's important to say a few words about the microscopy itself. Most of this would be sort of review, but I think it's useful to put in context for different kinds of specimens sort of what we typically do. And I'll just run through this fairly quickly. So typically we use 2 to 3 microliters of samples in the order of 1 to 5 mgs per mil. We put them on a Holey carbon film with holes on the order of 1 to 2 microns in size. If we magnify one particular image here, this is SD40. You can see there's a nice monodispersed distribution of particles in ice. Some regions are bare because the water layer was a little bit too thin to support the particles at the time of freezing. But yet it's not so thick over here that there are particles on top of one another. So this is sort of an ideal type sample. If we magnify a little bit more, you can see individual particles, and you can see lots of details within each one of those particles. And then we pretty much do most of our microscopy now at 200 or 300 kilovolts on a field emission gun microscope to get the kind of resolutions that we're trying to achieve now. We use the focus range typically on the order of 1 to 3 microns under focus, dose levels of 10 to 20 electrons per square angstrom. We still use film to record all of our data. We're not yet doing too many reconstructions with CCD image data. And again, a typical number of micrographs that we might record in a given project is somewhere on the order of 25 to 100 that will enable us to get somewhere in the range of 1,000 to 10,000 particles to work with the hopes that we could get somewhere in the range of at least 12 and maybe down to, 6 or 7 angstroms resolution ultimately. Okay, so most of you know that the data that you start with is pretty crummy, very low contrast. Once you've digitized it, get it into the computer, you can enhance the contrast and see things. And you can look at individual particles, but there's just so much you can do looking at individual particles with your eye. What you really want to know is how do you get information like this from two-dimensional images. So let's get started now. Here's a schematic of the process going from a micrograph to a 3D reconstruction and all the steps in between. Now be honest, how many of you are thinking right now, I really don't want to listen another 45 minutes worth of the details of how this thing actually works. I'd really just as soon not worry about it and go directly from the micrograph to the reconstruction. So I'll give you the chance now. This is your chance to exit before I launch into the details. Well, this is a very polite audience, or you're all asleep. Okay, so this is the flow chart I'm going to work with to try and walk you through how we go from a micrograph to a final structure that we can visualize and interpret. Now, I'm not going to be talking about this today. I'm just going to be telling you sort of how we go through it. And I know this is a lot to digest, and so I'm going to try and help you through some of the procedures one by one. And then also, I just want to point out that at each step, there are various programs that we're using to carry out these steps. But I know you're not interested in that now. The people taking the practical will learn more about the actual programs. But I just want to give you a feel for how we treat the data and how we get from the top to the bottom. The other important concept is that the nuts and bolts and guts of this whole process really revolve around this part of the flow chart where we're determining the relative view orientation of each particle, its center or phase origin, and then a process whereby we select and reject data, compute a three-dimensional reconstruction, monitor the quality, and then do some sort of cycling of that process. Okay? So that's sort of the nuts and bolts, and I'll say a little bit more details about that as I go along. So let's start at the top. Although I don't really have to say much about digitizing the micrograph, I think you probably have some practical experience doing that. You obviously have to take information from a piece of film, if you record it on film, and get it into the computer. The part I want to spend a few minutes on is boxing the particles. Okay, so here's a small field of view of actually a mixture of two viruses, but you know, we have methods for both manually and automatically picking out boxes or picking out particles, but just to sort of illustrate, we're going to window out our particles with a circular mask. That's pretty obvious for spherical particles. We have to find a particle, so we'll move it over here. We have to adjust the size of our mask. In the old days, we used to adjust our mask quite close to the particle edges, but that's dangerous because you may be leaving something out that's important, especially if you're testing any antibodies or receptor molecules on the outside of the virus and you can't see them with your eye. So you want to be liberal with how you box the particles. So it's pretty easy here. If we want to box these particles out, we can then window out sort of a square array, write that to a disk file, and do that, for example, for those three particles as shown there. So here's one particle that we've extracted from that digitized micrograph. Then we go through a couple other steps. First step is to mask out, you know, the information in the corners here. We don't really want that. We just want the information within the circular mask, circular window. So we mask it with a circular window. Then we do a process of floating, and I presume you've heard about the process of floating already. And then we also do a thing called apodization, which again, maybe you've heard, I don't know, which basically just applies a soft edge to this region here, just to sort of soften the blow, so to speak, between data and the background value there. It's a process called apodization. So here it is again. We extract the particle, we mask it, we float it, and then we apodize it. And just to give you a brief idea of why one wants to do that, if you look at the particle when it's masked within just a square mask, and look at the Fourier transform of this object here, the primary component that you see is this strong spike-like feature. And that's coming from the strong contrast that you see between the edge of the mask and the data here. There's two, set of vertical lines, horizontal lines and vertical lines that give rise to the strong spike. Well, you can apply a circular mask to that. But again, the Fourier transform is dominated by a series of circles, which is mainly coming from this information here at the edge. It has nothing to do with the particle. It has to do with the mask itself. So this is where floating comes in. If you float the particle now, notice how the transform sort of cleans up. And now you can see the true transform of the particle and not the transform of the edge of the mask that you've made. And you can sort of see that with your eyes. If I go back, if you're way back and defocused, all you're going to see is basically a sort of white hole in a black square. If I do this, now all of a sudden the particle becomes more prominent than the mask itself. The apodization is a very fine feature. I mean, maybe people in the front might be able to see a slight difference in the transform itself, but it doesn't make a major difference, but we typically do this with our data. So at the end of the day, you've boxed out, a number of particles. We can display that on a graphics device and sort of look at our data. So each one of these little squares is one particle that's been boxed out. And then the next step of the process is what we call pre-process that set of data that we've now boxed out. And again, there's a variety of steps involved in pre-processing. I'm not going to go through all of them. So the first one that we do oftentimes is this thing called remove gradient. So here's a field of view of some virus particles. And one of the things that's typical with looking at particles in ice over holes is that the ice thickness nearest the edge of the hole is thicker than in the center of the hole. There's a gradient of ice. And this causes problems in the reconstruction process and in the boxing process, especially automated procedures. So we do a fairly simplified procedure which tries to figure out, what a gradient is through the micrograph and trying to remove that to make it as if the particles are in a uniform thickness of ice. So we have a little window up here called manipulate.
We click on that, we get a menu, we come down here where it says linear gradient, we click on that, and now the gradient's removed. And you can, it's not a major difference, but that's with it removed, and that's with it not removed. Okay, so presumably if it's done correctly now, that at least the micrograph looks as if all the particles are sort of in a uniform layer of ice. Okay, so then again, we've got our data, we've applied that. You don't really notice much happening to the data when you do that. But we also do a process called normalized means and variances. Come up here to the manipulate menu, go down to normalized means and variances. And when we apply that, all of a sudden you notice that all the particles now appear to have essentially a uniform background, and the statistics of the fluctuations within each of those boxes has been normalized. So that the reason for doing this is partly to make sure that information coming from different micrographs or from different areas of a micrograph are normalized, so that when we do our reconstructions, we're not biasing it towards one particular micrograph or another. You've already seen this apodization process. That's often done at this stage after you've boxed your particles. Another thing that we do is to determine for each micrograph, for each data set that we get from each micrograph, we need to know what the focus level is for that micrograph. So here's another typical set of particles from one micrograph, and we can go up to this FFT window and produce a Fourier transform of that particular particle. The problem with the Fourier transform of one particle, it's very noisy. So what we can do is come down here and hit this little button that says average the FFTs, which means take all the particles, calculate an FFT for each one, and form the incoherent sum of those. When you do that, all of a sudden you can see more clearly for that particular set of data, you can start to see the tone rings fairly clearly, and those are used to help you define what the focus value was of that micrograph that you recorded days ago or weeks ago or whenever. So then we have various procedures for trying to either manually determine what that value is or let the computer do it for you. So you can start out by clicking this little box here, pick CTS points. You basically choose two positions, at orthogonal positions, of trying to identify the first node of the CTS. I put a little green cross there, a little red one up there, and then it will draw for you what it thinks the CTS parameters are. Now, in this particular case, I didn't take much care to do it right, and you can pretty much see, I think, with your eyes that I did a pretty poor job. So the red circle is what it thinks, where it thinks the first node should be, and the other ones here indicate where the second, third, fourth, fifth, etc. nodes are. Well, this is just for illustration purposes, because I think everybody here could do it better by eye. But we have a little function over here called defocus refinement. You hit that button, it opens up another window. It's not important about the details. The people in the practical may learn this. There's another button over here that says estimate the defocus. You hit that button, and it tries to figure out for you where the CTF actually is. In this particular case, which this is the typical example, right, it does pretty well on one cycle. And you can hit this flicker button to see how well things are. So I think now you can see that the rings are fitting very nicely to the rings that you can see with your eyes in the Fourier transform. And what it will do is it will say, for example, this micrograph, it says it's about 2.2 microns under focus. Okay, so we're done pre-processing the images. The next step is to establish refinement criteria. Basically, what this really means is that when you start out, you have to have some idea of what resolution you can expect to get out of your reconstruction. And you don't go for broke. So if you think, ultimately, I'd like to get to 7 angstroms. You don't start the process at 7 angstroms. You start at a much lower resolution because you're going to refine your data just like you would in any other procedure. So you have to make some decisions here as to how to get started. Now, typically, we would start at maybe 30 or 40 angstroms resolution. And there's some other parameters that we would define, but it's not important for this discussion now. So now we reach the point where we're actually going to go into the guts of this process. And that's and really the important part here, determining the origin and orientation. So the goal is to determine where the phase origin is for each particle and what the orientation view angle is for that particular particle. And in fact, it can be argued, but I think this is probably the most important step of the entire process. And in one way, shape, or form, it's the most important step in almost any image processing step, image processing methodology. Because I think, as you all know, or you will learn, as you try to practice these techniques, that if you don't get these things right, if you don't know where the particle center is, or what its view orientation is, you're going to just going to get what you put in. Okay? So, let's look at the icosahedron case now. We have this thing called the standard setting. So we set up a Cartesian coordinate frame, XYZ coordinate frame. In fact, an icosahedron is interesting because you can actually align a Cartesian coordinate frame with respect to three mutually perpendicular two-fold axes of symmetry of the icosahedron. This we call the standard setting. So we we're going to just show you how we define these angles. So theta, if we look at the XZ plane, we defined the theta angle as the rotation within the XZ plane away from Z towards X. Okay? In the case of phi, we look at the XY plane and determine the rotation in that plane starting from X and going towards Y. So, on the basis of that alone, you can ascribe theta phi values to the z-axis, the x-axis, and the y-axis. So z-axis becomes theta 0, phi 0. That defines the z-axis. The x-axis is defined by an angle of 90 degrees theta, 0 degrees phi. And y is going to be 90-90. And of course, you can define any way in which you view that icosahedron using those two angles, the theta and phi. Remember the asymmetric unit? So in the standard setting, we define this as our asymmetric unit, this particular one. Remember, there's 60 of them, but we're going to choose one of them. Because it doesn't matter how we view this icosahedron. Any view of an icosahedron can be referred back to one asymmetric unit because of the symmetry of the object. But in particular, we choose this one. And so here's just some particular view I chose. I said, well, what if you happen to be viewing along the direction theta 80, phi minus 15? So you'd be viewing through that part of the asymmetric unit. You'd be viewing that object along that direction of view, and you would assign those values to it. So the only other missing piece of information here is the omega angle. And that's because when you actually view this object, you don't know the orientation around that axis. Okay? When it sits in the microscope, it could be any way around that axis. And that defines the omega angle, the angle around that axis. So those three parameters, theta, phi, and omega, define precisely the view orientation for that particular particle. So here we have, again, an asymmetric unit of an icosahedron. What we've done is taken a model, bovine papillomavirus, so a high signal-to-noise model, and made projections at different angular orientations, at different angles of theta, different angles of phi. And one of the interesting things about an icosahedron is that there's a line of symmetry going between the twofold and the threefold. And in fact, the data on the left is mirror related to the data on the right. So in fact, in the processing programs, we can sort of ignore this part of the asymmetric unit and just concentrate on this part. And just to give you an idea here, these are fairly large angular increments, but 3-degree angular increments in theta here. 69 at the threefold axis, and you can see a nice threefold symmetry to that projection, going down to a twofold axis here, and going over to a five-fold axis here. But I guess all I want to show you is that notice that these all come from one three-dimensional reconstruction. This is an illustration, so there's no noise in this, or very little noise. But depending upon the angle of projection, you get different structures. So you can definitely see that that's different from that, and that's different from that. So 3 degrees is enough of a rotational difference between two objects to note that they are different. So what the programs are actually trying to do is to figure out, you know, does that thing correspond to a theta of 78 and a phi of 9? You don't know this beforehand. You're looking at noisy data, and you don't a priori know what the orientation is. Here I've cheated because I know I've generated the projections precisely as I wanted to. But just to illustrate to you that really the whole process, not just like icosahedral reconstruction, any technique is trying to take noisy images and try and fit them into a scheme of knowing exactly what the orientation angle is. So how do we determine these parameters? There's basically two ways to do it, or at least two ways that we've done it. The first method is the more tried and true common lines procedure that was developed by Tony Crowther and others. And this has certainly been very useful and used for a new or unknown structure. So if you have no knowledge of the structure you're looking at, you're more likely than not going to have to try some method of common lines procedures. The second one, so-called model-based, or a lot of people use the term template-based matching process, where you use a model to try and fish out the orientation parameters and origin parameters. And that's generally useful if you have some idea of what the structure looks like, not the details, but some idea, or you can somehow generate a model, say, in the computer that might be useful. Now, I'm not going to spend any time today talking about this. I want to talk more about this because I want to give you an idea of how one would get started if they had no other idea of what the structure was. So let's look at the common lines. So I'm going to break a cardinal rule here, and it should only take me about 30 seconds or so, but I'm going to read directly from this article here, and I call it The Gospel According to Tony Crowther. I guarantee you, if anybody here can understand what I'm about to read, while I read it, then I want to hire you. Okay? But the thing is that the way Tony wrote it is absolutely correct. And then I'm going to try to show you the beauty of the technique. So he says, common lines arise as follows. Any observed section of the transform intersects, so if you take a particle and you create its Fourier transform, if you're going to work in Fourier space, it intersects an identical symmetry-related section in a line, along which the transform must have the same value in both sections. The common line lies in the original section. However, regarded as lying in the symmetry-related section, it must have been generated by the symmetry operation from some other line in the original section. You with me? We therefore have a pair of lines in the original transform plane along which the transform must have identical values. A similar pair of lines will be generated by each possible choice of pairs of symmetry operations. That is the gospel. And the angular positions of these lines are dependent on the orientation of the particle. Hence the basis for the common lines method for determining what the orientation of this unknown object that you're looking at is. So now I'm going to try and put it into pictures and try and convince you of what he's saying in the words, which are absolutely correct. We have some 3D object. Don't worry about what it is. From that, we produce projected views of it. Okay, so we have a 2D projection, and therefore, you know, given its theta, phi, and omega angle, it's going to look different depending on what it is. And from that projection, we produce a 2D Fourier transform. This is sort of what we have to work with. So this will be sort of our raw data, our unknown. We actually don't know what the values are. So here we go. Now, this is a simple example, so I'm going to talk for the moment about an object which only has a single threefold axis of symmetry. Not an icosahedron, but just has one axis of threefold symmetry. Well, if we think of this object as just having a threefold axis of symmetry, and this is its Fourier transform, and we represent that transform plane as this red plane, A, B, CD here. This is the 2D transform of an image from a particle not viewed along an axis of symmetry. So this is a particular, this is not a special case, this is a general case. So we're not looking at the object down the axis of symmetry, just some other place. We don't know where it is. Okay, if we do that and we have this XYZ coordinate frame, which in this particular case, we're going to let the Z direction coincide with a threefold axis of symmetry. Okay, but we know that we're not viewing the particle down a threefold axis, some other way. So therefore, we know that this plane isn't viewed straight on. It's tilted a bit. I tried to represent, or I shouldn't say I tried. I stole this from Michael Moody's, one of his papers, and just colorized it a bit. Okay, well, we've got an axis of symmetry here, okay, and this is where the transform plane would lie relative to that axis of symmetry. Now, so we know the answer, but I'm going to show you where the common lines come from. So what we do is we apply the threefold symmetry that we know exists here to that plane, which means just take that plane, rotate it by 120 degrees. So A becomes, goes over to A prime, B goes over to B prime, etc. I've colored it differently so you can see the second one. Now, the threefold axis is also going to apply, generate an additional one that I'm not going to show for simplicity, but there would be three planes here. I'm only showing you two of them. Okay? So then what happens, though, is that notice that both planes have common values along the line 1, 2, 3. Remember, this is the transform of that object, and this is the same transform. It's just in a different orientation because we know we have threefold symmetry here. Okay? So we know that the values of the transform, okay, along that line have to be the same in both the blue and the red. But I'm going to pull it apart. So if I pull apart this one and then we look at it straight down here, we have points 1, 2, 3, right? 1, 2, 3. I'm going to take this one out now, place it over here, and realign it so that it's A prime, B prime, right? These are, in fact, identical transforms. All I've done is taken the transform and related it by the threefold symmetry that I know must exist in this particle, this example particle. So I've just shown you now that, in fact, these points 1, 2, and 3 lie along what's called a common line. So in this transform, it goes from here to here. In this transform, it goes from here to here. But yet, these are the same transforms. So if I take this and lay it down on top of that, I get something that looks like this. And so I get a pair of lines, which must exist in the original transform, that have to have the same values. We're assuming now perfect data, noise-free data, and it actually has threefold symmetry. That means that if you look at, for example, structure factors one by one along that line and track along that line at the same time, they must have exactly the same values. And only with this geometry. So an object that has one threefold axis of symmetry generates one pair of common lines. Okay, we're not finished yet. So let's go back to our sort of example here. Here's an example. Here's the common line coming from the original transform plane. Here's the, and there's the line over here. Here's the symmetry-related transform plane, which in fact must be the same. So there must be a line over here that's the same. Okay, what I've just told you is that if you go step by step along this line and step by step along this line, if the object that gave rise to this transform really does have threefold symmetry, and it's viewed in the orientation that I depicted in the last slide, then those two lines in that transform should be the same, and you can test for that. Okay, so you're already saying to yourself, yeah, it's easy with an object with threefold symmetry to sort of understand that basic concept. But what happens when you have something with 5-3-2 symmetry? And now, again, I don't have time to go into the details, but I'll just tell you the answer is, for a general view where you have a particle with icosahedral symmetry, for each five-fold axis of symmetry, you generate two pairs of common lines. You end up with 12. For each threefold, you end up with 10. Sorry, for the 10 threefolds that you have in an icosahedron, you end up with 10 pairs. And in the case of the twofolds, you have 15 twofolds, which give rise to 15 real lines. I won't describe what that means now, but the bottom line is you end up with 37 common lines generated because you have an object with such high symmetry. So here's another view of the asymmetric unit showing you what that pattern of common lines would look like if you were viewing the particle along a threefold axis of symmetry. That's what the pattern would look like of those common lines. And it would have the theta phi 690. Or if you happen to be over in this part of the asymmetric unit viewing it in that direction, you have a set of lines that look like that. It's a mess. Or if you're very close to a twofold axis, it would look something like that. Anyway, those patterns are characteristic of the particular view that you're using. So let's just take, for example, this particular view, 8011. We don't know that it's the right one, but this is what the pattern of common lines mathematically would be predicted to be. So the question now is if you have real data and you don't know what the angle is for that particle, you have to actually test to see how well does that data obey the expectation of that symmetry? So if we impose the expectation that this is going to be theta equals 80, phi equals 11, will basically draw this pattern of lines. Now, what you can't see by looking at the colors here is which lines belong to that need to be compared. So again, in this illustration, I'll just sort of do that for you. So first of all, we have to define an omega angle of zero by the pattern that we draw, irrespective of what way it was actually recorded in the microscope. And I just for illustration, I've said, well, what if this happens to be common line one and its pair here? We colored it red so you can see it. And one other one, which I just made up, here's maybe that's common line two and common line two. So the objective now is the programs actually go in and test the values along the transform here and here and see how well they agree. And they also do it along here and here. They do it for all 37 lines, and they calculate a phase residual. And you save that, and you say, well, how good is that, all right? And then you say, well, what about if, it, in fact, the view orientation is 80-11-1? Notice that that whole set of lines has to rotate by 1. You do the same process. You make the same calculation. Write that number down. You do it for 2, 3, 4, 5. I'm going to jump ahead, 10, 15, 30, 60, 90, all the way to 180. You basically take that pattern and rotate it around, make that same test, and see what sort of values you get. Okay, so the metric that we use here is to identify that omega that gives the lowest phase residual for all those possible orientations. But you're not done yet. Okay? In fact, you have to repeat that process that I just told you for all possible theta, phi, and omega orientations. I just showed you 80-11 and rotated omega. I've got to try for all possible orientations, and in the case of an icosahedron, if you were to take 1 degree steps, which is considered fairly coarse, you would generate approximately 250,000 different possibilities that you have to test for. But that's what we do. And at the very end of the day, hopefully one of those, the one that's correct, comes out at the top of the list with the lowest phase residual. And that becomes the one that becomes your best estimate for the particle view orientation. Now again, I'm not going to bore you to tears here. The same procedure can be used to determine the particle phase origin. Because remember, we need three angular orientations, angles to define the view direction, and we need to also know where the phase origin of the particle is. So I'll spare you the details on that. Now, you recall I told you there were two methods, common lines, and also the model-based template matching. In fact, the bulk of the structures that we solve now are typically using this sort of procedure. But again, we may discuss the details of that in the practical session, but I'll spare you the details here. At the end of the day, what you end up with is a data file that looks something like this. The first column has an ID for each particle that you box. The next three columns give you the theta, phi, and omega angle. The next two give you the XY position for each particle. And there's a bunch of other columns here. Let's forget that for the moment. So at that point, we've determined theta, phi, and omega and this particle center. Now we have to decide, we've got all these particles. Let's say we've got 50 particles from this one micrograph. Are they all good ones? We throw some of the data out. So the goal of selecting is everybody has to go through this process. You know, do we assume all particles are good and use them all, or do we actually test to see whether some are bad and try and get rid of them, at least temporarily? So that's what's sort of embedded in these. There's three correlation coefficients over here. Again, I'm not going to bore you with the details of what they are, but they give various measures of the quality of each of those images with respect to some model or some reconstruction. So we can go down this list, for example, this PFT correlation coefficient, and there's two particles here, particles 12 and 19, that have correlation coefficients of 0.784, 0.775. We can also scan up and down and find two particles, 16 and 26, that have lower correlation coefficients. Of course, the question is that bad? And in fact, you know, is that good? How do I know? Well, one way to tell is to go to the bottom of the file and see for that particular data set what the average correlation coefficient is for this particular kind of coefficient and what its standard deviation is, and you can develop a threshold and say just throw out particles that are say, less than one standard deviation below the average. I mean, one can devise different strategies for doing that, but nonetheless, there are criteria one can use to determine if a particle is good or bad. Because, in fact, you want to then compute a three-dimensional reconstruction using only your good data. You don't want to use bad data. So the goal, again, is to combine good images to compute a 3D density map. The basic procedure, I imagine it's already been discussed already. So in theory, you want to get the three-dimensional structure, but what you have in many of these analysis procedures is you're trying to compute a 3D Fourier transform from which you can mathematically compute what the density function looks like. Of course, in practice, you don't have that. You have it in the microscope, but all you've got are images, two-dimensional projected views, from which you can calculate two-dimensional Fourier transforms. You know how to put those back together. That's the big if. If you know how to put those back together, you can calculate a three-dimensional Fourier transform, and then in the computer, work backwards to get the 3D structure. And in the, I don't know, David, did you talk at all about big G's and little G's?
Yes.
You did. All right. Well, then I don't have to say any more. So the process and the people taking the practical, we can go into this more detail if you like, but I'm going to, again, spare the folks here now the detail. We start with computing a three-dimensional Fourier transform by combining information from projected images in Fourier space. From the Fourier transform, we can calculate these things called big G's. From the big G's, we can calculate these little things, these things called little G's, and from that we can calculate the density function. Again, I'm not going to go through the details of that, but the steps are from each image, you compute its Fourier transform. You combine all those Fourier transforms in a way which, in the case of an octahedron, you divide the transform up into a series of planes. On each plane, you have a series of circular annuli, and so this blue thing indicates maybe the way in which the Fourier transform cuts through that 3D Fourier transform based on its orientation. Because you have high symmetry, you can actually take that plane and replicate it 59 more times. And you can actually start to fill in data on these planes. So this plane for here, for example, is a series of annuli, but that particular plane is going to cut through those annuli in a variety of ways depending upon the orientation that that particle has. So you start to fill in Fourier space. From that, you compute these big G's. Again, I'm not going to go through the mathematics. You get a linear least squares problem where you've got observed Fs and these orientational parameters. You can calculate these big G's. From those big G's, using Fourier Bessel mathematics, you can calculate little G's. That provides you a density map, which is in polar coordinates, R theta or R phi z, and you can then transform from polar coordinates to Cartesian coordinates, which is sort of nice for representing the particle. We've computed our reconstruction. Another thing I'm not going to talk about here is during the process of doing the reconstruction, one can correct for the contrast transfer function effects, because we know for each micrograph they were taken at different defocus values. To get to a very high resolution, one has to correct for these effects, and we do that. That's done in this program, the program that's used here. We've got a reconstruction now. The question is, how do we decide if it's a good reconstruction? We want to assess the resolution of the density map to determine what do we do next. So very quickly, what we do is we actually back up a few steps to where we select the images, and we say actually subdivide the data set into even and odd sets of particles. You can do that randomly. And from each set, so you basically divide your data set in half, you compute a reconstruction from the even images, from the odd images. You then mask each of those reconstructions in a way that's illustrated here. It's not important what the structure is, but here's reovirus. What we can do is just decide that all the stuff on the inside here with the genome is not something that we really care that much about for the purposes of determining resolution, because the genome may not have icosahedral ordering. Likewise, outside the particle, we know that there's nothing out there, so why add that noise to the analysis or the metric that compares the data? So we can mask it like that, so there it's masked, and then we basically calculate from those masked reconstructions a set of structure factors from the even data and the odd data. We can compare those structure factors and compute and plot phase residuals or phase differences and correlation coefficients as a function of spatial frequency. Here's an example at the end of a process, not at the beginning of a process. So here's an unmasked reovirus particle. Correlation coefficients plotted here against spatial frequency. And the general metric that's used in the field is to draw a line at the correlation coefficient of 0.5. It's somewhat arbitrary, but you watch where the curve crosses the line, and in this case it crosses at about 8.7 angstrom resolution. That's for unmasked. If you say, I know that there's nothing outside a radius R2, and the stuff on the inside is not correlated with icosahedral symmetry, so you mask the particle, like here, then you get a curve shown in the black line. And although it bounces a little bit around 0.5 here, it basically goes out to approximately 7 angstroms or so resolution. So the data within that radius and that radius are good to about 7 angstroms resolution. Another thing I want to make sure that you understand is that the quality of the data is not necessarily the same throughout the map. I can illustrate that here. We now calculate as a function of radius what is the resolution where you cross that 0.5 correlation coefficient threshold. So in this case, you can see that there's this big well here, so that if we draw a line at 7 angstrom resolution, we see that at a radius of about 245 on the low end and 363 on the high end, all the data within those radii are at or a little bit better than 7 angstrom resolution. But if we increase the radii, or we reduce it here and increase it here to look at a larger area, then the data within that range is only good to 8 angstroms. And if we go from 232 to 405, it's only good to 9 angstroms. Okay, so it isn't constant throughout the structure, and one can test for that. Another thing that we can do with the programs is you can actually go back and look at your data and say, look at why is a particle bad? So we don't do too much of this anymore when we get up to, say, thousands of particles or 10,000 particles. But in the early stages, it's useful to actually look at your data and compare it to the current reconstruction that you have. So we have this thing called particle processing. We click on it. It pulls up. I don't know how easy this is to see. But it draws an asymmetric unit here and shows you where all your particles in that micrograph sit with regard to the theta and phi angles with respect to the asymmetric unit. You can go click on any particle that you want. It'll pull that particle up and put it in the screen for you. So you can look at any data that you want. So if I pick out this particle down here, which I know is close to a fivefold axis, click on it, it pulls that particular particle out. You can see what number it is and all the statistics that go with that particle. So you can sort of look at your data in this way. You can also do a thing where you basically take your model, your current reconstruction, and you click this box over here. It will simultaneously produce a projection of the model along the direction calculated currently for that particular particle. You can compare them by eye. It's something that we used to always do in the old days, is look at our reconstructions and look at the back projection of the reconstruction and compare it to our individual particles. And so here I'm doing that for that particle. I'll just show you another example here. This one up here is, I can't see from here. There's that one. There's one here that's close to the threefold axis. You can sort of compare the model versus the actual data as a way of sort of, and you can also look at the correlation coefficients and get an idea what's bad, what's good. I'm getting close to finishing, so I know I'm going to run over just a little bit here. So at this point, you ask the question, am I done? Okay, you don't like to say, yeah, let's get this over with now. Generally, the answer is no, because you've only done this cycle once. You've only taken this micrograph through once, calculated the first reconstruction, looked at it. And so we say, yes. We generally say, yes, let's refine. Again, we haven't quite implemented this yet that is doing refinement of the CTF parameters, but eventually we will put that into our processing scheme. But generally what happens is we come back up here, we decide, do we want to try and increase the resolution? So we may have started out at 30 angstroms. We say, now let's see if we can get to 25 angstroms. Let's sort of work our way out to higher and higher resolution. And the way we do that is now, by forgetting about using this, say, initial model in the procedure I did describe for you, but we make use of the reconstruction that we just calculated. So that information feeds back into the process of determining the orientation and origin parameters. Okay, so no matter how the process started, once we've got one reconstruction that's obtained from the data, you feed that information back up and you start refining these parameters here, making a new selection process, calculating a new reconstruction, monitoring the quality. Did it get better? If it got better, you might say, well, no, maybe I'm not done yet. And you keep cycling until eventually you get to a point where, let's say you're 10 angstroms and just nothing is getting any better. So refinement isn't going to do me any more good. So now the question is, do I want more data? Usually the answer is yes. So I go back up here and add in micrograph number 2 and start the process of micrograph number 2. Okay? So I go through that process until I finally run out of gas and I say, no, I don't want any more data, but maybe I want to go back and rebox my particles. When I first box them, they may have been a little bit off, and so we make minor adjustments and rebox the particles. We may want to box the particles in such a way that instead of maybe initially we might have scanned the micrograph at 14 microns or so, which might correspond to, let's say, 5 angstrom pixels, and we've reached, say, 12 angstroms or so, we realize that we can't get any further with pixels of that size. We have to go back and go to smaller pixels. So we may rebox and resample our data and get started again. Thankfully, eventually you get to a point where you say you are done, yes, and that's when you get to visualize and interpret what you've got. Although I might add that a lot of that is done in this process anyway. You're always looking at your data, trying to assess where you're at. And then we definitely go through a process of archiving our data. So let me just finish up by just giving you a quick, this should only take a minute or so, just an idea of where we're going right now. So one of the things that we're doing, and we have been doing, is parallelizing the programs. So the program that calculates the three-dimensional reconstruction, the one that does an initial search, and the one that does the origin and orientation refinement, these have all been parallelized now, and we run a lot of these programs on Linux clusters. But we're also developing new algorithms. So we're getting to the point where we're probably not going to be using the Fourier-Bessel methods anymore and using a new method. This is just called parallel three-dimensional reconstruction program, but it works in Cartesian coordinates. It has certain advantages over the Fourier-Bessel methods. And we are actually already using some of these programs, but they're still in development. Likewise, this OOR program, we have a program called POR, or Parallel Orientation or Origin Refinement Program, but it has a different strategy, okay, than the one that we're using here. Another thing that, of course, everybody's doing these days is automating things. In the practical, people will get some flavor for what we do for automatic boxing or semi-automatic boxing. We also have some rudimentary procedures now for doing this whole origin orientation refinement part, the guts of what I told you about, where you do lots and lots of cycles, and you just basically set it off and running for days, and it monitors things, and it selects particles and tosses particles out. And at the end of the day, you better end up with a better reconstruction than what you started with. So the procedure is basically doing what a human being gets tired of doing. And lastly, we do another, we haven't done this yet, but and again, I don't know if this has been discussed here, but if you do this process that I indicated, where you divide the data at some point into even and odd sets and compare them, strictly speaking, you're not doing a fair comparison between two reconstructions. We call them independent reconstructions as a way of testing resolution. But in fact, they're not truly independent because the process of determining the origins and orientations of all of the particles was done with respect to one model or one reconstruction. So there could be some bias. Generally, I don't think there really is. But one can solve that problem by just starting the process right from the beginning and dividing your data at the very top and doing two whole sets of parallel processes where you process all your even data by itself, all your odd data by itself. They never talk to each other. At the end of the day, you'll end up with two reconstructions, which now you can compare them and determine, you know, in a rigorous way whether they agree to a certain resolution. If they agree, then, of course, you can add that data together at that point. So this virtually should eliminate any bias in the resolution assessment step, And it will allow you, at the end of the day, to get a final three-dimensional reconstruction at the highest signal to noise. And believe it or not, that's it. Thank you. That's a good question. So the question is, you know, what causes a particle to be bad? And so I'll give you a little bit of historical background. When I got started in this business longer ago than I'd like to admit, and I'm talking about when we started using cryo microscopy to obtain our images. And so compared to the days when people were doing negative staining, where there's lots of contrast, as you know, the cryo images are much lower contrast. And so when we first we're doing refinement of orientations and using the various programs to try and determine what the orientations were, I was probably confident in only about 20 or 30% of the particles having the right values. So I was typically throwing out 80% of my data. Okay. Well, today, it's really more of the opposite. In fact, we actually believe most of the particles are actually quite good and should be used. So to answer your question, if in the early stages of the determination of the parameters, you have what's called a bad particle, my guess is that, in fact, it's probably not a bad particle, it's probably a good particle. But the reason it's bad is because you've actually gotten a wrong estimate of the orientation and origin. Part of that could be because your centering was a little bit too far off, and that really makes life difficult. If the center is off, the orientation is... the determination of the orientation is going to be offset as well. And as you get a better reconstruction, you bring the bad data back in. You keep retesting it, and more times than not, the bad data turns out to be okay as well. Of course, you know, really bad data is a particle that's falling apart, and you just didn't see it. And we're going to have more and more examples of that as we do automatic boxing. We're boxing tens of thousands of particles. No human being is going to look at every single particle. So we have to have good tools to weed out bad data for whatever reason, and then maybe even classify them as to why they're bad. We do that. Yeah, so did everybody hear that? So the masking process that I was describing for determining resolution, so it's basically saying, you know, it's not really fair to compare the entire structure because we know certain parts of it are not going to correlate with icosahedral symmetry. So let's cheat a little bit and get rid of those parts and so we can get better statistics. We can use the same procedure. We use that model, in fact, to do the refinement. In fact, we can also play some other games as well, which I don't know if you're in the practical or not, where you can apply inverse temperature factor correction to try and enhance the high-resolution features of the model as a way of trying to get to higher and higher resolution. Now, some people might argue that you're sort of cheating, and I'd say, yeah, we probably are cheating, but the proof of the pudding is the data still has to eventually give you a reconstruction, and you have to be able to make a test of how well you're doing. If it isn't in the data, you'll eventually reach a point where the data just won't get any better than 10 angstroms or 9 angstroms or whatever, no matter what you do. Right. It's a great question. It's that, you know, we argue constantly, what does resolution mean and how do you measure it? And I think I said, if I didn't, that the numbers I was giving were sort of arbitrarily decided by whom, I'm not sure, but in the field we tend to believe that a correlation coefficient of 0.5. So you measure, you calculate two maps, you calculate structure factors from those maps, and you compare the structure factors as a function of spatial frequency. At very low spatial frequencies, if everything's gone well, then the correlation coefficients are generally right about 1. Eventually you reach a point where the correlation coefficient starts to drop as a function of spatial frequency. And so when you reach a cutoff of 0.5, again, it's arbitrary, and I think it's actually conservative. Most people, I think, would agree it's sort of conservative. So if you cut it off at 0.5, what you're saying is that in the case of the one I showed you, at about 7 angstroms resolution, you have reasonable confidence that you can resolve details at 7 angstroms. But below that, your confidence level is less than 0.5 in terms of correlation coefficient. It's just an arbitrary number. Yep, absolutely. Because one can imagine if I had 10,000 particles, I divide them into 5 and 5, this is going to have square root of 2 higher noise in each map. Okay, so when you compare those two, so if you had 20,000 particles, all right, you'd be able to compare 10,000 and 10,000. Well, 10,000 is what you end up at the end of the day. But, and I actually was trying to put together a slide that actually shows for the real virus structure, for example, if you start with, in that case, there's like 8,000 particles. You can just keep subdividing it in half and half and half. And you can watch the trend as you go to lower numbers of particles, that curve starts to nosedive sooner and sooner. So you can sort of predict what would happen if you go to twice as many particles. And you know the signal to noise, assuming they're averaged properly, should go up by square root of 2. So again, it's a conservative, I think it's a conservative estimate. Which one? 33. Oh, well. Don't look at the numbers. That's way after 33, I think. Well, it should be close. I didn't change too much. If it's page 33, then you have to multiply by, what, 4? Getting there. Okay, like one of these? Yeah, that's the, yeah. Okay, so you're talking about if we go back and say, look at the incoherent sum of the Fourier transforms of particles from a given micrograph, do the tone rings go out to 7 angstroms? The answer is yes. We do see data, and that's the beauty of these field emission gun instruments that we use. But sometimes, and I'm sure Nigel will probably talk about this tonight, I mean, there's data out there, even if you can't see it with your eyes in the transform, and David, I'm sure, must have said this sort of same sort of thing. Almost everybody here has been doing this. You know, there's actually information out there in most cases. Do we see it? Well, we see it if it's very gross. You know, a particle gets squashed for some reason, and of course we stay away from those sort of particles. But I think eventually it's going to become something we have to live with and deal with if we get to very high resolutions, because there might be small distortions. Certainly many viruses actually are very dynamic. They can breathe, for example. my feeling then is, of course, that you've got a problem. You're probably averaging together images that shouldn't be averaged together. We have to go to classification methods to try and sort that out, sort out different distortions. But we're nowhere near, like, correcting for distortions like, say, for example, what Nigel does. Thank you for asking that question. I haven't shown any of that here, but we have, in fact, devised some of the programs to allow us to basically use no symmetry if you want to, or use other sorts of symmetries, like 522 we've used on the Gemini viruses, which are two-headed viruses. So they don't have icosahedral symmetry. And we have looked at bacteriophage 529, which is a prolate bacteriophage, but we assume a fivefold symmetry, an axial symmetry. So we can do some of this with the same sort of programs, but the big problem, of course, as you might imagine, is that with icosahedral symmetry, you have 60-fold redundancy. As soon as you start to relax that, say fivefold symmetry, you need 12 times as much data, and you have fewer common lines, for example, to test for, so the signal-to-noise becomes more of a problem. Well, I'm not sure what your question is. We can certainly do it, and we have. And in fact, that's another way to sort of prove that something has a symmetry. If it has a symmetry, you assume no symmetry. And if what comes out, if that symmetry shows up in the reconstruction, you can sort of use that to help you determine whether, in fact, that symmetry does exist. Yeah. I mean, we've tried this. In fact, one way we've tried it, but we just haven't pushed it hard enough yet, is that you can actually do a reconstruction that imposes the symmetry, and then, of course, you've now got a model. A good model is, say, the capsid. And you can generate a model that just has that and subtract that signal away from all of your images and produce a set of data which is essentially remove the capsids from your particles. But we haven't yet been able to get enough data to actually see if there's some sort of a unique structure on the inside which doesn't obey the icosahedral symmetry. We tried this a number of years ago with SB40, looking at the mini chromosome on the inside to see if it... And there's some evidence to indicate that there was some unique structure, but of course it doesn't have icosahedral symmetry. But in those days, we just didn't have enough particles. I think you need tens of thousands of particles to make that work, so you can start classification methods. Good question. I don't have the answer to that. And it's always been the sort of $64,000 question, why icosahedral? I mean, there certainly are some enzyme complexes, I think, that have octahedral symmetry, right? And there must be some that have tetrahedral symmetry. But there are some viruses that have dodecahedral shape, okay? So you could call it a dodecahedron or an icosahedron. Yeah, but why nature chose icosahedral for viruses still unanswered. Thank you.
Yeah, so that's absolutely true, and I thank you for pointing all that out. Of course, as soon as you have a beautiful, simple theory like that, that does seem to hold for most simple viruses, but then you've got things like polyoma that disobey these rules. And as you get to more complicated viruses, I think that argument eventually sort of breaks down. But then you're still left with why do they still, like this alnovirus, T169, it's got over 5,000 subunits, but it's got icosahedral symmetry. Why? I don't know. Yeah, sure. There's a lot of... Certainly is some correlation between the amount of genome and the size of the shell that's made. In the case of the algoviruses, they have a genome of the one I showed of 330 kilo base pairs. It's enormous. So it takes a big vessel to put that in. But I can give you also other examples where the vessel that nature decided to package the genome is too big. It's never too small, okay? But it's you know, bigger than if you or I were to decide let's build out of the structural subunit that we're given, you know, should we build a T=1 or T=3 to house this particular genome? And there are some examples where nature has, for whatever reason, decided to build the bigger vessel. But yeah, there is a correlation between size. I think a lot of phages are that way. Yeah, they package as much as they can, and then the DNA gets cut off, and then another particle gets a different part of it. It takes multiple infections to get. Yeah. So what I said was not totally true. Yeah.
Okay, this is Frank again.